We have so much breaking news literally happening in the minutes before going on the air today that it's really kind of difficult to know where to begin. But everything that's happening relates very directly to the subjects we're going to talk about on today's show, particularly the terrorist attack, the awful terrorist attack in New York City yesterday. We'll, in just a moment, start discussing that and the president's comments about that and much more. Excuse me. Joining us today, we got a full house. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. What are you working on? What are we going to see with your byline on it tomorrow?
Well, we've got some mayor race stories. Me and Tamar, who's also on the show, I don't want to spoil her intro, but we have a big Sunday story piece about Republican Party in Georgia a year after Trump's election.
Okay, and you just mentioned it. Tamar Hallerman joins us from the Cox radio studio in on the Hill in Washington. Tamar, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. I guess, you know, after my intro has been ruined by Greg.
Don't worry. We'll make up for it tomorrow. We're also joined by Connor Sen. He writes about financial matters, most typically, for Bloomberg Views. Connor, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're going to come into a busy season as the tax plan is rolled out, whenever that might happen. We're going to get to that in the show today. And Howard Franklin, Democratic political consultant, government affairs expert, does a lot of lobbying down at the Capitol. How are you doing, Howard?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you for being here. All right. So let's start talking about the breaking news. Let's take it with the most recent thing that happened just within the last 15 minutes. The president has been making a series of statements, comments about the terrorist attack in New York City. The most recent thing he said 15 minutes ago was he called for quick justice and strong justice. Those are quotes for terror suspects in the wake of the deadly New York City attack. And here's a direct quote. What we have right now is a joke. It's a laughingstock, and no wonder so much of this stuff takes place. He is referring, according to CNN, the New York Times, and other news organizations, to the justice system in saying it's a joke right now. Within about 15 minutes of that, a few minutes earlier, he said that he definitely wants to end the immigration lottery. We're going to get into that. And he thinks that perhaps the suspect in this case, Sefulo Saipov, ought to be sent to Guantanamo. Mm. So that's just the starting point for our conversation. Tamar, let's go right to our Georgia angle on this. You talked to Senator David Perdue about the terrorist attack, and he referred to his RAISE Act, which is the immigration bill that he's been pushing on the Hill, to end the lottery system that brought the suspect into the country. He had a green card. Fill us in on all of that.
Sure. So this is a bill that Senator Perdue's been pushing since about February. And back in August, President Trump signed on, which really helped give it a big push. We haven't seen a ton of movement on it yet, but Senator Perdue saying, you know, this incident in New York really highlights why we need to get this done now.
And the president helped him in that, although he didn't refer specifically to the RAISE Act. The president said that the immigration lottery was a terrible mistake, and he actually blamed this attack indirectly on Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, saying that they were the ones who put the RAISE Act in place. Immigration lottery in place. But just to give that context, let's listen to one of the things that David Perdue had to say to you.
It's a tragedy in New York. I mean, we didn't see that. Obviously, I hate it. Forget about the numbers. I mean, every individual that alive is lost is ridiculous. This is something we've got to face up to and defend. One of the ways we do that is looking at our archaic immigration system. This diversity lottery has been abused. It's fraudulent. And here's an example of a guy who came in and is under a green card. So we didn't anticipate this, but it certainly heightens the issue and why we're so focused on it.
So, Tamar, just in terms of David Perdue's bill, we know that it hadn't gotten much traction, even with Trump's backing. Do we have reason to believe, and does Perdue think that this attack may, in fact, help his bill gain the momentum that it hasn't had so far?
He chose his words really carefully today when I asked him about that. He thinks it does incentivize the need for Congress to pass his bill, but he was also careful to say, I haven't talked to people since, you know, the attacks yesterday. It's possible it could get a little more attention, especially with the president tweeting about it several times this morning.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to win over any extra Democrats, especially with the president attacking Chuck Schumer on Twitter this morning.
Yeah, let's, Greg, this morning, here's the tweet from President Trump. The terrorist came into our country through what is called the Diversity Visa Lottery Program, a Chuck Schumer beauty, referring to the minority leader in the Senate. I want merit-based. It turns out the president has his facts wrong on this.
Yeah, the history is a little bit more nuanced. That program was set up by Trump, was created in 1990 by a bill supported by Senator Schumer, but it was also passed with bipartisan votes and signed into law by President Bush. So it's definitely had bipartisan, overwhelming bipartisan support.
And a number of years later, I think around 2008, I don't have it right in front of me, Schumer was one of the members up on the Hill who wanted to make changes to reform that act.
In 2013, as part of a broader comprehensive immigration overhaul that stalled amid Republican and some Democratic opposition.
Okay, so let me throw this out as a kind of a jump ball. Anybody grab this? The president very quickly, early this morning, turns this into a partisan political issue. What do we think about that? Howard?
So many things to think about it. I mean, obviously, none of this is going to help him pass any legislative measures or any policy measures that will actually address what the issues are. But that's part and parcel for how this president and his White House has operated.
What struck me was after every mass shooting, there's calls on the Republican side of the aisle, but also some on the Democratic side of the aisle saying, no, let's not rush to a reaction. Let's think this through. And, you know, last night, almost as soon as the attacks started happening, we saw the same thing, calls for political responses.
Right.
And that's what Senator Schumer actually brought up today when he took to the well of the Senate, saying after the 9/11 attacks, we had national unity. Where is that now?
I think the other...
This is Connor.
Yeah, the other thing related to the partisan part is that Senator Jeff Flake, the Republican senator in Arizona, who announced he's not running for re-election this morning, sort of fired back at President Trump's tweet. And so, you know, now that Flake and Bob Corker in Tennessee are not running for re-election, you might see them sort of bridge the middle and call out Trump if they feel like he's out of line.
One thing that struck me this morning with the president's tweet is, you know, the fact that he very much needs Chuck Schumer at the end of the day to strike a deal with the Dreamers. So it's interesting that he's kind of calling it out. I wonder if it's enough to kind of sap any goodwill that was there after, you know, the president met with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, it sort of follows a pattern in which President Trump, without regard to which members of Congress he needs on which pieces of legislation, decides to go after them. But here's one of the things I'm interested in, Tamar. You know, the president last night tweeted out some very strong messages, basically saying we are not going to let ISIS attack us in our homes. We are going to get tough with them. But here's what I wonder. At a certain point, you know, the president certainly, every time there was a terrorist attack anywhere in the country or in the world during the campaign, turned around and blamed it on President Obama. At a certain point, despite the fact his base may very well stick with him, does he own any further, and God forbid there should be any, terrorist attacks in this country in the same way that it appears from polling people in this country now think he owns health care? Is he at some point going to own a ongoing terrorism?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think in general, no matter who is president, whenever there's a problem in Washington or on Capitol Hill, it's always blamed on the administration. But what Trump has proved it so powerful doing is, at least with his core supporters, those people who will never leave him, they don't blame Trump for any of these problems. They blame Congress. They blame the Democrats. They blame everybody else but Trump. He can do no wrong.
Well, which is what the power, Howard, of this tweet today was. It's Chuck Schumer's fault that the suspect got into the country.
Yeah, and I guess it's possible to assign or assess that blame in the absence of an election. I think we're all counting down to the midterm elections, and I think we'll find out once and for all whether or not the American people are holding the president or other people he's pointing out as responsible for these travesties.
All right. Well, we're going to watch. There obviously will be a lot more on this, and will be fascinating to see whether, in fact, the Justice Department responds to President Trump. I assume it's the Justice Department tomorrow that could. Do we still have a system? Does anybody know? For sending prisoners to Guantanamo?
Yeah, no right. one arrested on American soil has ever been sent to Guantanamo yeah. Bay. And no one captured on foreign soil has been sent there since 2008. So
okay.
it's been years.
Okay. So I assume it's the Justice Department that it would be Jeff Sessions who would make that call. Yeah. Do we imagine that's true?
Yeah, okay. But we're also not sure how serious Trump. This was yeah, in response right. to a question that Trump was asked about it, so we don't know.
Absolutely, and thank you. I won't go down that road right now. So let's talk about the other big story that broke nationally this week. Tomorrow, on Monday, we saw the two indictments and a guilty plea in the Mueller investigation. Nobody wanted to talk. When you went out, as I assume you did tomorrow, and chased down Georgia senators and members of the House to get their reaction to this, I assume they scurried away as quickly as they did from reporters from all over the country, yes?
I think that the response to a lot of folks is, hey, how about that tax reform? Let's talk about tax reform instead, or let's talk about this uranium deal with Russia that happened when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Let's talk about Podesta. Let's talk about anything else.
We get that. They don't want to talk about this. But is there a pall? Do you sense when you sneak up on them? Do you hear them? Are they whispering to each other? We hear more and more, and I'm not asking you to reveal anything that's off the record, but we hear from more and more people. And in fact, I think Greg Bluestein, you and I probably have heard it ourselves. There are Republicans who are serving in Congress who, off the record, we'll say they're increasingly worried about this President Trump and the Russia investigation.
Yeah, I mean, even if they're not solid supporters of Trump, like we know a lot of Republicans weren't a year ago today or 18 months ago today, the Never Trump movement, especially here in Georgia, has, you know, among Republicans, has largely vanished. But they still, a lot of the Republican lawmakers and officials in Georgia still hope that he can pass big parts of his agenda, and that's what they're worried about. They're worried about these investigations sort of clouding everything else, all the priorities that they, you know, whether they like him or not, they still want passed.
So they're willing to stick with him to get the agenda passed. We know that, Connor.
Right, and that's the question is, you know, if and when tax reform does pass, what's the thing binding Republicans in Congress to the president? And is it cultural issues? There's no other significant legislation that it seems is on the agenda, so there'll be a pretty big vacuum once that moment passes.
Well, aren't they going to want to then try to go back and get Obamacare repealed? Aren't they going to move on to any number of are you suggesting there's no other agenda from the White House?
Given the fact that we're coming up on 2018 and the primaries and then the general, I think by March, okay. that's going to be it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think we've had enough bites at the apple for Obamacare. I think that there's some other things that may be bubbling up to the surface, but nothing that we've seen broad agreement on in terms of making a priority.
So what I'm curious about, and I throw this out to any of you, is obviously, everybody's been talking about this in all the news programs, and we're not going to try to recreate the whole story about the indictments the other day. But there's been some interesting reporting on George Papadopoulos, the one guilty plea that we have now, a foreign policy advisor to the president. The president's tried to distance himself, saying, oh, I really don't know him. But let me throw out to you all the one piece of information that seems to come the closest so far to tying the campaign to Russia is the report that at this meeting on March 31st, 2016, the candidate Trump and Jeff Sessions had a meeting with the foreign policy advisors, and Papadopoulos was, you've already seen the photograph, mm-hmm. most people, sitting right there between the two. We have now learned that Papadopoulos at that meeting proposed that the Trump campaign should communicate with Russia, should talk to Russia. Jeff Sessions shut it down immediately, the reporting is on this, but apparently not everyone in the meeting agreed it should be shut down. The president, candidate Trump, didn't weigh in one way or the other. And Greg, it strikes me that is the closest we've come to the kind of connection that the White House is furiously trying to paddle away from.
Yeah, by saying he's basically a coffee boy for the campaign. But we've got anecdotes like that. We also have Trump's own statement saying that he was a terrific member of the team early last year, at the same time when Republicans were growing increasingly worried about his foreign policy bona fides. So there's the word that I think that strikes fear in the White House is the fact that he is I forgot what the term the feds use, but he is a collaborator, right? He's not quite an informant yet, but he's someone who's looking like he could flip. He could be used in the prosecution.
And I believe the indictment did say that he agreed to cooperate with the feds
yes.
and provide information.
Yes.
And I think part of that's what's striking so much fear in Washington is, you know, I think a lot of people see this Papadopoulos agreement as kind of Mueller saying, you know, reaching out to all these other higher level people on the campaign saying, well, we have Papadopoulos, you know, he has dirt on you guys. Who's going to help us get to the president?
And nobody knows at what point he may have been wearing a wire in any of his ongoing meetings with members of the Trump administration. So that story will continue to play out, and who knows where it will lead. One of the questions that we'll ask, we're going to take a break, but in a couple of minutes after the break, we're going to turn to the tax reform bill that Republicans had hoped to roll out today. It's now been delayed for, they haven't quite worked out what they want to propose, apparently. So we'll get to that in just a minute, but let's take a break on Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Producer Tom Faust brought me yet another breaking story. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has just responded to President Trump's criticism, saying this: President Trump, where's your leadership? The contrast between President Bush's actions after 9/11 and President Trump's action this morning could not be starker. He said that in a speech on the floor of the Senate. He said, in a moment of national tragedy, President Bush understood the meaning of his high office. President Trump, instead of politicizing and dividing America, should be bringing us together and focusing on the real solution, anti-terrorism funding. So that story continues to play out. All right, Tamar, I think you, like a lot of people on the Hill, thought maybe we were going to see the tax bill that Republicans have been writing behind closed doors today. It's been delayed. What's the word up there? Are they going to get this bill out this week at all?
Well, so after they delayed it last night, they were saying definitely Thursday, definitely.
Yeah.
But now the word on Twitter is that that might, you know, slip to next week.
Oh,
my. So who knows at this point? You know, I feel like there's a lot of last-minute scrambling to not only get the math to work out, but in order to kind of quell the nerves of a lot of people. There's a ton of business interests who are freaking out about what may or may not be in this bill, and I think there's a lot of nerves.
Do they make the Thanksgiving deadline?
It's going to be very, very difficult.
Well, they're not going to—you mean for passing a bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's going to happen. Conor Sen, this is your wheelhouse.
I think the fact that they don't even know what they're going to call the bill, nor are they even willing to just put the bill out there, forget a vote, sort of says how worried everybody is about what to do here.
What was the president's idea?
Cut.
The cut bill. Boy, the guy knows how to market, that's for sure. Conor, here's the Republicans. We don't want any more we don't want any more deficits. We want to, you know, balance our budgets, that sort of thing. What do we think the deficit is going to be based on some of the things we've heard over the next decade about what they're doing?
So based on the budget they passed, they put a $1.5 trillion place mark in there for the tax bill. And so that's the constraint that they have. We know that they want to cut about $5 trillion worth of taxes. So those things are in agreement. The hard part is, where's the $3.5 trillion revenue offset to pay for this? And that's where nobody really knows. Every time anything gets floated, whether it's state and local taxes or 401k deductions or anything else, people flip out. And so, you know, it's really not clear where this is going to happen.
Yeah. So we have heard, and again, we know this isn't, we're not, we have no idea what's going to be in the final bill. But Howard, we do know, as Connor just pointed out, a few things they've thought about. Eliminating the mortgage interest deduction, which if you're, I think, a middle-income homeowner, this is a particularly important deduction for you, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think making policy that fits on bumper stickers, I guess it works in the campaign setting. It just has not worked for this administration. I think what we find is every time there's something proposed, we run into a roadblock and we come right back to square one.
Yeah, I mean, especially on that, if you're a homeowner, am I right, Connor, if you're a homeowner with, say, not that you're not making a good salary, but if you're making, say, around $100,000, you don't have a lot of deductions the way somebody who's in the multi-million dollar category. And that mortgage deduction is a crucial piece of how you try to lower your tax bill.
Absolutely. I mean, especially if you have kids like I do, it's, you know, that's a big part of sort of what, you know, gets you that the house you want and then pays for everything else with your cost of living.
Okay, so we don't know, Greg, if that's going to be there or not. We also, Connor mentioned the ceiling on 401k contributions. And again, this is a measure. The proposal could very well be that you will only be able to contribute up. Do we know an amount they've been throwing around? It's varied.
As low as $3,000.
As low as $3,000. So there now, Greg, you look at the potential for attacking us, the way in which many Americans save for their future.
Yeah, and particularly, I mean, the supporters of these limits basically say it's only helping wealthy Americans who can save up to the max, which is what, $18,000, I think it was
something like that. Yeah.
But for a large part of the of that base, and that many of this is the Republican base, they have used this as a tool to save tens of thousands of dollars a year over the years.
Tamara,
this is made more complicated by the president, who you know, unprompted will say things, being like, "No, we're not negotiating on this," and the Republican negotiators saying, "What? Of course we are.
Yeah.
Why are you undercutting us?"
Yeah.
As President Obama found, it's very difficult to raise taxes on the upper middle class. He tried to phase out the 529 sort of program to save for kids' colleges, and that was immediately shot down. And that's sort of a more niche program relative to mortgage interest or 401ks.
One of the matters that they've really been catching a lot of heat on is whether or not to allow the deduction for state and local taxes to remain in place. And one of the reasons that's a particularly tough issue, Tamar, or particularly divisive issue, is that it tends to be Democrats who live in the states that have higher state income tax. California, New York, New Jersey, I think, is right there. There are an awful lot of people who are paying a lot of money in state income tax in those states. They're Democrats, and they may lose that deduction, and that's caused an uproar your way.
No, well, not only that, but there's a lot of Republicans from those states, and they constitute a really key voting bloc for trying to pass tax reform with Republican votes. So once those people rebel, that's a good 20, 30 people. And then you're worried about numbers. You're worried, if you're Paul Ryan, crap, I might not have enough votes to pass this thing.
So they're scrambling on that. They've got a proposal that would instead replace the deduction on income tax, state income tax, with a deduction for property tax. Have I got that right, Connor?
So the irony in all this is we're really hashing out these very minutiae details that are, you know, important to a small segment of the electorate. But at the end of the day, if they figure out a way to pass something, it's going to be kind of like a replay of the health care bill, where it goes to the Senate and they're going to say, okay, kids, go play off in recess. Now the grown-ups are going to take care of this. They're going to start over and do their own thing. And it comes down to what Sue Collins in Maine will agree with, and maybe John McCain, and all this housework will be for naught.
Yeah, Howard, one of the problems that we saw unfold during the health care debate was Republicans insisting on taking this behind closed doors.
Sure.
And not following John McCain's suggestion. let's return to regular order and do things through committee, through hearings, through an open process. Are they heading in the same direction because they've done this in secret that they did with the health care bill? Or are Republicans... Well, let me ask you just that and then ask Tamar to follow up I wanted to ask.
Tamar will definitely have a better sense than I do. I think, one, it's hard to know what direction they're heading into. And I think as long as you've got a central stakeholder, i.e. the guy in the White House, who can disrupt all of the negotiations, can put anything off, take anything off the table, put something back on the table with 140 characters. God save us if Twitter does go to 280 characters. I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, you'll be putting out pronouncements left and right. But I think it's difficult to ever come down with a direction, knowing that there's one person who can derail the entire conversation.
All right. Given as complicated as all this is, let me start with you, Tamar, and then invite everybody, anybody else who wants to jump in on this. We know this is not an easy path. But Tamar, are Republicans up there so frightened about 2018 and their chances for reelection that they are going to, that fear is going to unite them, despite whether they are on the far right, the middle, wherever, to pass something? Is that going to be the prevailing impetus to get this thing passed?
Yes, but yes, it's everybody's terrified, especially after the Republicans couldn't pass a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. They know that they need to do this to kind of save their skin for 2018. On the other hand, I think people are realizing how complicated this is with different interest groups fighting. So I happen to wonder if we're going to end up with just going to tax cuts at the end of the day, because it's just a much easier lift politically. And I feel like you're starting to even see the president lay the groundwork where he talks about tax reform, yes, but also tax cuts.
And there's also a chance you can have dueling versions of these bills so that lawmakers can go back to their constituents and say, we passed a bill, but, you know, that pesky House blocked it. Or we passed a bill, but, you know, it couldn't get through Senate approval. So, I mean, it happens here in Atlanta all the time where you have Georgia lawmakers do the exact same thing. They can sort of declare a partial victory. This is what I tried to do for you, if only.
All right. Well, once again...
Yeah, I think the path to passage of something is actually pretty straightforward in that in the budget, they laid out a $1.5 trillion deficit they're willing to accept. And so if they could scrap this big reform and just say, okay, how do we divvy up the $1.5 trillion, they can get that done.
All right. Well, we're going to watch that unfold. Tamar, your bet is it going to be now next week, but possibly before we see this thing?
Oh, I've learned better than to
guess
these days.
Yeah, I know. That's I understand. That is definitely not a fair question. Let's turn to another story this week that really caused some heads to spin, I think.
Which one?
Yeah. Well, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly went on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News, and she asked him about a church in Virginia that has had plaques honoring George Washington and Robert E. Lee. The church decided to take them both down. Concerns about, obviously, Robert E. Lee, a Confederate leader, George Washington, a slaveholder. And she asked him what he thought about that. And this is where Kelly got himself into some rhetoric that has troubled a lot of people. First, he praised Robert E. Lee and said this was a man of great courage and conviction who was willing to give up his country to go back and fight for his state, which, Kelly said, was perfectly fine in those days, not so much now. I'm paraphrasing him, obviously. But let's listen to him say it himself.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
So that's one thing he said. And then he went on to say that the Civil War could have been avoided if the South and the North had agreed to compromise. Greg Bluestein, what's the compromise?
I'm not really sure. And a lot of the reporters who cover him a lot were just astounded by the fact that he answered the question. I mean, if you watch, he very rarely speaks publicly. And when he does, he's very quick to say, I'm not answering that question. Let's move on to another question I will answer. So the fact that he answered it that way was kind of stunning. But one of the best responses I've seen to this on Twitter was from Ken Burns, who made the Civil War documentary. He wrote, "Many factors contributed to the Civil War. One caused it, slavery." There's no question.
Yeah, Howard, I just, you know, with all due respect to John Kelly or anybody out there who thinks that way, this notion that somehow that you could compromise with a slave-holding section of the United States and come to some agreement is really troubling and offensive.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I need to repeat anything you guys have already said here. I think the part to note is that this was someone who was offered to the American people as someone who could really focus Trump and kind of save him from his own worst impulses. And maybe the Trump gravitational force is just that strong that otherwise sane people started to say insane things. I don't know any other way to describe this.
Well, on top of that, he seems to ignore history. Tamar, we did reach the three-fifths compromise, offensive in and of itself, in which an agreement was reached between the North and the South that slaves would be counted as three-fifths of a human being for a variety of purposes. The Missouri Compromise, which established which states could be slave states and which couldn't. Does General Kelly, do we think, not understand history?
What I think is so interesting, I want to piggyback off of what Howard said. I think that when John Kelly started, everybody wanted to paint him as this, like, you know, buttoned up general who was going to calm the president down. But over the last few weeks, we've seen a different kind of man emerge. You know, we've seen him talking about Frederica Wilson, the Florida congresswoman, and, who was in the car with the widow, the Green Beret widow, when she got the call from Trump. We've heard this now from Laura Ingraham. Perhaps he's a little more in line with Trump and some of his more controversial beliefs than we thought he was.
Yeah, it does. There are people who've said that when you get in the Trump orbit, Connor, somehow or another, you're going to find yourself in trouble fairly quickly. And John Kelly seems to have been a part of that thought.
Right. It seems like the only sort of two paths anyone seems to go down is either you agree with Trump and you sort of get caught buying into his outrageous comments, or you look like Paul Ryan and you just say, "Oh, it doesn't matter. We're focused on tax reform," which makes you look somewhat ridiculous. There's really no good way to play this.
You know, this reminds me that when Jim Wagner, the president of Emory University, got himself into hot water a couple of years ago, when he wrote a column for the Emory, I don't remember if it was the newspaper or their alumni magazine, he wrote a column, though, saying that the problem with us today is we're not willing to compromise, we're in our partisan corners. We should look at things like the three-fifths compromise as an example of how we all came together. And, I mean, Wagner realized almost immediately that he had done a stupid thing and said so publicly and tried to repent for that. It hurt him in the long run. But this is very reminiscent of what happened at Emory a couple of years back.
Yeah, and of course Wagner ended up apologizing.
Yeah,
well, in this case, the Trump policy has been no apologies. They've rarely moved back. They've rarely reversed any positions, and for that, their supporters love him for it. You know, he's a no compromise, strong backbone type of guy. But to a large segment of the electorate, it's appalling.
Okay, so there are two other things that I think are worth unpacking with this. One, Tamar, is just what Greg said. Not only is there no apology from Kelly, but the White House Sarah Huckabee Sanders challenged whether or not it was appropriate for the media to attack, which is what she described it as, a four-star general. How inappropriate. And this is a very similar line to what they took a few weeks ago in the battle that Kelly got into with the poor widow and Congresswoman Wilson down in Florida. This notion that it is not appropriate to be critical of a general really is very troubling, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's definitely a way that they're using to kind of try and control the media a little bit. And hopefully the media won't bite. It's our duty to ask questions, you know, hard questions of people in power.
Yeah, the other thing that troubled me, Howard, was this notion that Robert E. Lee was a hero. and deserves to be treated as a hero because he, quote, left the country right. to defend his state. Now, again, even if Kelly puts this in the context of 1860, 1861, is this a window into the way Kelly thinks about our loyalties?
I mean, if you're listening to the spin doctors in the White House, I guess they would say no. But I think what we've seen in the last year, year and a half, is that the only way to get any truth in these conversations is to start holding people accountable for what they're actually saying, whether it's in 140 characters, whether it's explaining something that has nothing to do specifically with the White House or not. So, yeah, I think we, as Tamar said, we're sold a bill of goods as it related to John Kelly, and it's turning out not to be true.
I need to do an exit question on this segment. Is there anyone on the show today who thinks that under any other administration, John Kelly would not be out of work today? Does anybody think that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton would have not only not defended this, but said to Kelly, I'm sorry, you're out?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to probably go with that, yeah.
All right. Before we take a break, let's listen to Stephen Colbert talked about this. He talked about the comments that Kelly made about Robert E. Lee, and then you'll hear the rest of what Colbert said.
Kelly's historical scholarship didn't stop there. He also had an interesting take on the root causes of the Civil War.
The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
And of course, we all remember John Wilkes Booth's famous cry as he shot Lincoln. Can't we at least talk about this? What do you mean there was a lack of compromise? The Civil War happened because of compromise. The Missouri Compromise. The Three-Fifths Compromise. You're a general and you don't know why the Civil War happened? What do you think caused World War II? A zoning issue?
On the next Fresh Air, Lindy West, who writes with anger and humor about misogynistic trolling, misogynistic comedy, sexual harassment, fat shaming, and women who benefit from feminism but don't embrace it. She confronted one of her trolls on an edition of This American Life. She recently started a weekly column for the New York Times, and her book Shrill is out in paperback. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Oh, my gosh, we still have so much to cover, and we're already two breaks into the show. Tamar Hallerman joins us from the Cox radio studio in Washington. Where are you? Where is that studio?
It is right in the shadow of the Capitol.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. What do you mean by the shadow of the Capitol? It's not in the Capitol itself. I haven't been in that studio. Are you over at 400 North
yep.
Capitol?
400 North Capitol, so about a block away.
I know that building well. Used to work there a lot. Greg Bluestein from the AJC is here. Connor Senn from Bloomberg Views is with us, and Howard Franklin, Democratic political consultant. Before we move on to a couple of local stories, I thought this, today began the enrollment period, right, for Obamacare, for ACA, and a country not heard from recently went on the website to make some remarks.
Hi, everybody. It's November 1st, which means today is the first day to get covered for 2018. Healthcare.gov is open for business right now. You could save money and spread the word to make sure everybody knows that it's time to get covered at healthcare.gov. Because this country works best when we look out for one another.
Former President Obama on the healthcare.gov website. I love the fact that they used a banjo to accompany him, Greg.
Yeah, it was very lilting.
Very jaunty.
Yeah.
And I think there might have been a kind of a sneaky message about President Trump at the end there, about coming together and being healthy together, essentially. Tamar, let's, before we leave Washington, you had an interesting piece on David Perdue. We talked about him early in the show, but you had an interesting piece the other day about how Perdue just sticks right at the president's side. He is one of his most loyal lieutenants on Capitol Hill, right?
Yeah, and I would argue more so than almost anybody else on Capitol Hill. Even when the president attacks his mentor, Bob Corker, even after the most controversial remarks on things like Charlottesville, Perdue has been there and, if anything, has only strengthened his ties to the president.
You know what's interesting about that? Given that Perdue ran his entire campaign as a deficit hawk, How does he justify the fact that he will no doubt be with the president on this tax bill, whatever it looks like?
Yeah. So as we mentioned earlier, it would add about $1.5 trillion to the deficit. But Perdue thinks it's okay because while in the short term it could add to the deficit, he thinks the economic growth that it'll, you know, that the tax cuts will provide will help stimulate the economy and help plug the budget hole in the long term.
Connor, that is the Republican argument on this. It's always been the Republican argument on this sort of thing.
So here's the weird thing is that we've had two consecutive quarters of 3% growth. The Atlanta Fed came out this morning saying they're looking for 4.5% growth in the fourth quarter. Unemployment's as low as it's been in 20 years. And so it's what's going on here? And why are we so focused on tax reform and growth? And rather, what are the challenges facing the economy and how do we address them? And I've written recently that I think a shortage of labor due to demographics and immigration, other things, as well as housing due to some of the after effects of the Great Recession, are really the challenges we need to be addressing, but we're talking about 1980-style tax reform still.
All right. Well, we know that. I thought, you know, Tamar, I'm going to – I think you're behind the paywall at Politically Georgia, but I think people, if they can, they ought to read your piece on Perdue. It was a really interesting profile.
And they should subscribe and sign up for PoliticallyGeorgia.com.
Politically Georgia, yeah. We talked about it on the show enough that you guys – I don't know why you're not underwriters, for goodness sake.
That was a nice plug, Greg. Yeah. Good plug.
Bert, if you're listening.
He's talking about their managing editor at the AJC. Let's move on to a couple of other issues that take us outside of Washington. Greg, we've been going through this strange, I think strange, question about whether the state election computer at Kennesaw State University was in fact at any point recently hacked. Mm-hmm. We know there was a hack some time ago in that computer, but that computer and the data on it became a piece of a lawsuit filed by a number of organizations that believe that Karen Handel may not have won the 6th district race legally. The FBI went in, took the data off the computer. They said they'd look at this. But then when the organizations that were bringing the lawsuit wanted to look at it, they were told the computers were wiped clean to prepare them for further use in another context. Do we have any reason to think, first of all, that the election was fixed, and second, that there was anything nefarious about repurposing that computer since the FBI already had the data?
On the first count, we now have Representative Hank Johnson saying that he does think that the election could have been tossed, could have been fixed. We have not heard from John Ossoff, and that's kind of where I'm drawing my like sort of internal reporting line. If John Ossoff comes out and says that there's questions about his election, then I think, you know, we have to write a lot more about it. Until he does that, I'm not quite sure for our purposes. On the second count, we're not exactly sure how important this whole wiping of the server is. We know it's a big deal. We've obviously reported all about all the ins and outs of it. And today we have another piece of breaking news. The Attorney General's office says it cannot will not be defending the Secretary of State's office on this issue. They've retained Roy Barnes, former Governor Roy Barnes' legal counsel, a law firm, to defend the state on this action. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. The FBI is not commenting. State authorities are not commenting. We saw from Secretary Kemp's office last night that their internal investigation revealed that there's nothing to see here. How deep this goes continues to be an issue that we're all following.
So, Howard?
I just think all uncharted territory. I mean, to the point that Greg made about the John Ossoff coming back. I mean, we don't have a process for retroactively, you know, unpacking the results of an election and deciding whether or not, you know, it was fairly adjudicated. So I think, you know, I think we're much like in D.C. and now here in Georgia as it relates to elections in uncharted territory, and I'm very interested to see how it unfolds.
All right. Well, a companion story to that one is that there's now a national voter transparency organization that's been looking at that. What happened up there at KSU, and also looking at the Atlanta mayor's race, and is now challenging the city of Atlanta to not use voting machines next Tuesday in the mayor's election, but instead to go to paper balloting. well, this is not going to happen a week before the election.
But this group, it's called the Coalition for Good Governance, and they've been kind of all over Georgia voting issues for a few years now. And they have spurred some change. There is going to be a test paper ballot in a few precincts around the state on Tuesday. But what they're also calling for is a complete overhaul of Georgia's voting system. And there are some legislators on both sides of the aisle who are supportive of it. Now, this could cost tens of millions, maybe even $100 million+ to do everything that some of these good governance groups want.
Tens of millions, and we did this when Kathy Cox was Secretary of State, I guess, around 12 years ago. And I think really the question is, will legislators insist on a statewide approach to procurement for a new platform, or will we do what we've always done traditionally, which is allow individual elections divisions and offices to procure the technology
prefer? Let me see if I've got this right, though. Kathy Cox was here a couple weeks ago, and that's one of the things we talked about with her. She was Secretary of State when they made this change. They did that statewide, as I recall. You're suggesting perhaps various independent jurisdictions might be able to change machines. That would be an interesting approach.
As I understand it, they're allowed to do so now. They can have individual refreshes and only every so often. So we went from paper to touchscreen, and that's why it happened. I mean, the question would be, is this a technological advance that would require another statewide decision?
Tamar, is ballot integrity an issue that you hear people talking about up there? I mean, Georgia is in a somewhat unusual case. I think there are few states that don't have some kind of paper trail. Georgia's one of the few that doesn't. Is this an issue they talk about on the Hill in various states?
Not particularly. You hear a couple Dems talk about it. A couple Democrats like King Johnson will talk about it occasionally, but not really.
Okay, so we think this is very much an issue right here in Georgia. Greg, what's the betting on whether or not we are going to end up with new machines with the paper trail, which does seem to make a lot of sense.
I mean, House Democrats have made this. Bob Trammell, the new House Minority Leader, has made this one of his top priorities, if not his top priority of next year's session. But of course, the House Democrats are in the firm minority in the legislature. It's a big ask for lawmakers in election year to set aside however much $1 million it could cost, you know, upwards of $100 million. And you're not hearing Governor Deal or Republican leaders talk about it. So I think it's a dim possibility.
Connor, I mentioned on the show, we talked about this a little bit the other day, and I thought that the whatever push there is for this, and I think it's more, I understand Greg's point that among legislators, it's a group of Democrats who particularly would like to see it. But the voters, the people of the state of Georgia, like people all over, have lost faith in their institutions. And we don't have necessarily faith that election returns are honest anymore, in the same way we don't have faith in so many of our institutions today.
I think the irony here is that if we have lost faith in the quality of the elections, the integrity of the elections, the only sort of way we can solve it is by entrusting those same institutions to fix them. And so there's kind of this recursive problem in the whole arrangement. And ultimately, I don't think this is going to go anywhere in the near term.
All right. We vote next Tuesday. I want to get a quick prediction from Howard Franklin, if you're willing. You're not working for anybody in this race.
No.
We're going to have a runoff. Who's it going to be between?
Well, we had another topic that we were looking at, and it was about Caesar Mitchell and looking at the GBI investigating what's happening. I don't know if we got time to bring that up or not.
Do it. Yeah, we've talked about it on the show, but let's do it quickly. There was a money raised by a state transportation, I mean, an initiative for transportation in the city of Atlanta. And a lot of that money, $500,000 of it, is being distributed to various candidates for mayor who are friendly as city council members to the mayor. And now Caesar Mitchell, a few days before the election, is calling for an investigation, which may be a part of his campaign.
So, yeah, my contribution to that conversation was to say, I think, like many things in politics, it's a bit of both. I think it does call some attention. It does maybe forestall that expenditure. I think the polls show us, you know, Keisha Lance Bottoms and Mary Norwood. But I do think I've heard from pockets of voters in the city that Vincent Fort's still making a push and that Caesar Mitchell's also still making that push.
You know, Greg, I think with 80,000, 90,000 voters in this thing, If you can get your people to the polls,
yeah, that's exactly what it is.
That's the answer.
Turnout. I mean, right? there's not going to be that many undecided voters voting. They're just going to stay home. So a lot of the candidates are just focusing on their most fervent supporters because they think that it could be as low as 15,000 votes gets you in that runoff.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's anyone's game. It really is. Even though the polls and even pollsters say, and we've had Mark Rountree on the air say this, it's almost impossible to reliably poll this race because there's so many undecided, inactive voters who just won't vote, who haven't been paying attention to this race.
All right, we're out of time for today's show. I want to thank you all for a really great conversation, and especially since we had so much ground to cover. Tamara Hallerman, it's always a pleasure to have you joining us from Washington. Thank you for being with us. Connor Sen, Bloomberg Views. People can read your stuff if they go to Bloomberg Views on the web, and you will be right there, yeah?
I will.
Okay, Howard Franklin, thank you, and Greg Bluestein. We look forward to your reporting tomorrow on the mayor's race, and who knows what else your byline will be attached to. You're writing constantly for the paper.
Busy time to be a political reporter.
All right. It's tomorrow, a two-way street. We have a really interesting show. As we move toward daylight savings time, we're going to ask a couple of questions of an expert on the history of American time. Number one, why do we still have daylight savings time? It may have been a good idea at the beginning. Now people think of it not only as not working, but in fact, perhaps being hazardous to our health. But more important, the bigger question is, whoever established some kind of standard time in the United States? When did we decide that 12:05 in the afternoon was 12:05 across the country? You will be surprised when you listen to the show that that didn't happen until the latter half, moving toward the end of the 19th century. So our conversation tomorrow on the history of American time and on why the heck we're still paying attention to daylight savings time. So that's tomorrow on Two Way Street. Friday, we'll be back with Political Rewind, and I'm sure, you know, maybe, Connor, by Friday, there will be a conversation about a tax bill rollout. Tamar doesn't think so.
Maybe it'll be Friday, maybe it'll be next week.
All right. Well, we will look forward to seeing what happens there. Loretta Lepore will be with us on Friday, and so will Michael Owens, the chair of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. So that ought to be a terrific conversation. My thanks to Olivia Rheingold, to Tyler Morris, and to Tom Faust. Tom Faust must have, I think, maybe lost 4 pounds running breaking news stories into the studio today. Thank you for keeping us on top of everything, Tom. And thank all of you for listening to Political Rewind today. We'll be back tomorrow with Two Way Street, Friday with Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. See you then.